everybody. This is Mutumbi Swana from Black and Brown in Bioethics, and you're listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, the show that gets together with academics to question academic hierarchies, structures, and conventions, unpack their inherent issues, and find solutions together. Today, we're talking about disrupting hierarchies to improve education with Annabelle Shoimimo and Emeka Ofia. Annabelle is a physician, PhD candidate, founder of the Reproductive Justice Initiative, and a writer. She wrote the book, Divided, Racism, Medicine, and Why We Need to Decolonize Healthcare. Emeka is a professor and consultant pediatric radiologist. She's the first Black African female professor at the University of Sheffield, and probably the third Black African female professor in medicine in England. We'll discuss hierarchies and how they are built, their experiences, disruption, and the impact of change. Thanks for joining us, Emeka and Annabelle. Would you like to start with a little bit about you and how you're connected to Power and Privilege in academia?
Hi, hello, I'm Emeka Ofia, Professor of Paediatric Musculoskeletal Imaging and Honorary Consultant Paediatric Radiologist at the University of Sheffield and Sheffield Children's Hospital. Within the university, I'm the Faculty Director for Wellbeing and EDI, and I've held other similar roles at departmental level, and I'm also the University Co-Chair for the Race Equality Charter Application Committee.
Hello, I'm Dr. Annabelle Shoimimo. I'm a community sexual reproductive health registrar, and I'm author of Divided, Racism, Medicine, and Why We Need to Decolonize Healthcare. I also co-direct the Reproductive Justice Initiative, which is a charity which focuses on inequalities in reproductive health, and particularly looking at the colonial legacies in sexual reproductive health. So in terms of my interest in disrupting hierarchies, it's pretty integral to a lot of the work I do, including my academic work. So I'm also a part-time PhD candidate at King's College London, and I'm looking at the reproductive lives of Black women in Britain.
I'm just going to go straight in and talk about hierarchies and how they're built. So whenever I start something, I always like to know how people define or perceive it. So the first thing I did actually about this podcast was like thinking of what hierarchies are, and I Googled it. And first definition that came up on Google was that the classification of a group of people according to ability or to economic, social, or professional standing. So what do you think of this definition, and what do academic hierarchies look like?
Yeah, so I think that definition makes hierarchies sound quite benign. It's saying the class, you know, it's just giving you the classification. I think that unless you actually talk about the impact of hierarchy, you're missing the point. And the point really from my perspective is this introduction of power or privilege, that the higher up you are in the hierarchy, that the more power you have. And that may not necessarily be the case in all hierarchies, but certainly it's the general thing. Mankind likes to stratify ourselves according to who's on top and who's not on top. And everybody's then, those at the bottom are scrambling to try and get to the top. And those on the top are trying to keep their position, maintain the status quo. So I think that would be my criticism of the definition, that it's not always bland, it's not always so sort of lacking in the annoyances to do with power. I mean, so much of academia is related to sort of hierarchies, real or imagined. You can even just divide the staff into the professional staff and the researchers, the academic staff, where often there's the feeling that the academics are superior or given more privileges and benefits than the professional stuff. It shouldn't be the case, you know, that we all have our roles that we contribute. But if I just take my area, which I'm an academic, so if I was to concentrate on the academic, it's hierarchical from the very get-go, isn't it? The minute you arrive as an undergraduate student, you're kind of here year one, you know, then year two, then year three, depending on how many years of your course. Then you're a postgraduate teaching or postgraduate research, and then you come into academia, lecturer, senior lecturer, if you have a reader position in your university, or associate professor, and then professor. So there are always all these ranks and rankings, and then within them you'll have somebody who's a departmental head or a faculty head. You'll have somebody who is the journal editor that you're trying to get your manuscript submitted to and published. You'll have somebody who's the chair of the grant panel. You'll have somebody who's the chair of the interview panel. So there's power and hierarchy at every level. And don't say that it's completely negative. It isn't, because we need hierarchy for law and order. The abuse of the power, the misplaced power, that is wrong.
Who decides what the hierarchy looks like and where the power is?
I don't know who decides. Isn't it just it's the way it's always been? I really think we are used to that. Things are organized for us. So we go to nursery school, we go to primary school, we go to secondary school, we go to university. It's the order of life. It's the way it's been ordered. And actually, to have things work, you do need a certain sort of managerial system, a hierarchy. And human beings, we are competitive. We need competition.
Yeah. True. So when it comes to like kind of these hierarchy formation and the result of individual variation and influence or power, where the most valued member achieves the highest status. So maybe something a little bit more simple is in the UK, like accents and dialects like Brummie, Scouse, Cockney, the creme de la creme, the Queen's English that sits at the top. And this actually is one of the most salient examples of British classism that remains its attitude towards accents today, towards certain accents. And I'm curious to know how you've experienced and seen labels influence medical and academic hierarchy, and if they have a part to play in differences in patient care.
A lot of my work has looked at how we have been taught to categorize human beings racially, and looking at how that plays into health inequalities and how that impacts society and reinforces systemic injustice and inequality, and how these categories, racial divisions, are continuously reproduced within medicine, and looking at that legacy of race science and the history of eugenics and how it still filters into some of our practice today. And really trying to articulate that without examining some of these historical legacies within medicine and understanding how they came about and they continue to manifest, we can't really try to create a more equitable system of healthcare, because there are still some deeply embedded tropes around race, whether that's like intellectually and talking about intellectual inferiority along racial lines, whether that's talking about bodies and people thinking that like black skin denotes strength. Or we even saw some of these ideas kind of being replicated during COVID, you know, the idea that there is like this binding thing of blackness amongst all black people, and people not really understanding that how the category of like black due to brown skin has come about, how that is not upheld through any kind of scientific understanding or principle. So when we look and try to justify doing medical treatments on along racial lines, how that's very poorly evidence-based, because there's not data that shows we have these defined racial categories. There's a lot of genetic variability across the African continent. It is the most diverse continent genetically in the world. And just like trying to understand and look at some of those things, I'm very much thinking about how hierarchies have been established along racial gender lines, the misogyny, sexism, and racism that is very endemic within medicine, and how that manifests not just in our treatment, but also in our lives as doctors and clinicians, and particularly within the NHS, which is very much built through migrant labour.
If you're talking about personal experiences, I'm fortunate to the extent that, I'm a radiologist, so I tend to be on the wards far less frequently than when I was actually just doing my general medical training. But in those days, if people saw you, they always would automatically assume you were the nurse or the, you know, somebody to do with catering or something, rather than the doctor. You sort of get used to it, quite honestly. I didn't take it in as a... They have to assume you're someone or something, don't they? And so that's the assumption that they made, and that maybe would just reflect their experience in hospitals. And in those days, so I'm talking about 15, 20 years ago, in those days, the scarcity of black female doctors. So it may not necessarily be reflecting an individual's perspective of you. It could just be reflecting what society was in those days. It's very clear. There are lots of papers and publications that will tell you about the health disparities based on race. There are so many different indices that one could talk about. I could talk about, you know, maternal survival. I could talk about mental health. We could talk about COVID-19, the very recent pandemic. And then you can move away from patients and talk about the NHS pay gap. There is a pay gap within the NHS. There's chronic illness. I remember last year, there was that publication, wasn't there, by the NHS Race and Health Observatory. There had been a paper done by a group in Manchester, and they looked at five areas. And I think maternal health was one of them. They looked at genetic testing and three others. And it was very clear to them that there was significant racial disparity affecting health outcomes in our NHS. The NHS then had said they were putting things in order to tackle them. So it's there. But I think it's so much more than, you started off by saying accents are different. It's just so much more than having different accents. It's one of these things that I know the paper I've just referred to, one of the issues was that they were with neonates, with young babies, newborn babies, especially the Asian newborn babies, and presumably also for the blacks, trying to diagnose which babies have jaundice by trying to see how yellow their eyes and skin are, when already we have a discrepancy, you know, so that the charts wouldn't be the same. What is jaundice in a person of my colour or a baby, you know, of colour compared to a white baby? So sometimes it's because of the training has been on whites, and the books and everything is based on whites, and the research has been on whites. And so the outcomes and the data that is normal data for whites may not be normal data for Asians or blacks or mixed. So some of it is institutional, and it's not really on a personal level.
Yeah. When you talked about more of a personal level, and you were talking about being on the ward, and I guess 20 years ago, another thing is we probably weren't used to seeing female doctors as much either, not even just like female black doctors, but female doctors too. So I wonder, there's almost like two parts to that.
No, there were certainly when I trained, there would have been equal amounts of male, female. I gravitated toward the females, I don't know. But I'm thinking back to when I came from Nigeria, I trained in Nigeria, and the first hospital I worked in was Old Church Hospital in Romford in Essex. And certainly, as I'm thinking back to the doctors, I can certainly be thinking, I'm seeing more females, I'm thinking of their names more than the males. So I don't think that the sex was an issue at that time. It was definitely race.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first black female. I didn't know I might have been the first black at all. As I say to people at my interview, the doctor said he will give you the job. You obviously speak English. So,
well, what did you say to that?
This was the first job I had, and I'd applied. I'd sent hundreds of. It's not an exaggeration. I had sent hundreds of CVs. It was all paper those days. I'd posted so many job applications through, and I hadn't got shortlisted for any, and I got. Not just shortlisted, but I was offered the job. So I think he could have said anything to me and I'd just been fine. But I wasn't sure. It was a bit like gaslighting. I wasn't sure if I should take it badly or not. So I walked out of the interview room, and it was the health, not the health, what do they call it? The human resources lady. That was the title that they held those days. The human resources officer. She led me out and she said, oh, don't mind him. So it at least validated my feeling that this was an odd thing to say at the very least, you know. And she was just don't listen to him. It doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. You know, maybe these days she might have taken a stronger stand. But to be, you know, I wanted the job and I got the job. So, and yes, of course I spoke English. I had been here for years before I went to Nigeria. And
well, yeah, like it's just I don't know. I have so many comments about this. It's just, yeah.
I tell the story a lot because it was my first professional exposure to these sorts of, well, I call it a microaggression. I don't know what to call it, really. It was my first exposure to these things. And I laugh about it. And you know, but is it a laughing matter? Who's to say? I also tell the story a year later, doing ward round, I was on the ward and some of the other doctors were there, and he called out to me, the same doctor, I wasn't married in those days. Dr. Ndamali, he said. And I looked up, he said, we've just had interviews. We've just employed another one like you.
Oh God. Like this is, oh my God. This is really like just, I don't even think it's a microaggression. It's just straight up aggression.
Oh dear. People looked at me and I looked at people and none of us quite knew what to do. So that he was saying this as he was walking towards me. So by the time he got up to me, he'd said it and he was up to me and I just said, oh yes, he said, we just had interviews. And she did really well. So I just thought you'd like to know. I use it to say to people, we are each other's ambassadors. I always say it, you know, that's fine. I obviously had done well enough that year that encouraged him to offer somebody else a job that was a Nigerian or a black girl. Do you know? So that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a positive way to look at, like, a bad situation, but it is, it's like it's true, it's like, okay, well, you did something that made this person like see things differently.
I think that it's complex. I think that particular doctor was not racist. I think a racist wouldn't have employed either me or the other person.
True.
I think it's the leftover of colonialism. I think it's this hierarchy where he feels superior, and he almost wanted to be, he wanted me to thank him and be and ingratiate myself to him for employing both myself and the other. But I don't think it was racism.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know.
It's still... microaggressions. I'm not actually excusing it. Please do not get me wrong. I'm not saying this is the way to go about talking to people. But I think what I'm saying is it can be, it's not black and white. It's and forgive the pun there. It's complex.
Yeah, that's true. There is so many like different things that play into it. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, The Danger of a Single Story TED Talk in 2009 explores the negative influences that a single story can have as it can rob people of their dignity and emphasizes there are so many differences amongst like those of us who are homogenized under a particular label. How do we ensure we're not talking about a single story in academia?
We just need to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to say their piece. We need to look at things from all perspectives. For that to succeed, it means that every panel, every committee, every sort of set of teachers, the curriculum itself, everything needs to be diverse and representative of the people that we teach and the staff that we employ, so that these different voices can be held. I know that at our meetings, I think one thing that is good is to try and encourage everybody who's sitting on the committee to contribute. And some people are shy and quiet and will not necessarily interrupt or raise their hands. But if you go around the table at the end, or if you have a particular staff member or student who you know is more withdrawn than others, afterwards on their own, on a one-to-one, you can ask for their opinion. But I think that before major decisions are made, everyone should be given an opportunity to give their perspective on that decision.
Absolutely agree. And I think The Danger of a Single Story is quite central to a lot of my own work and my own journey. So in terms of Chimamanda's work in particular, I remember hearing that TED Talk, and I was part of TEDx Houston team, which was centered to bring the African story and African innovation to light and ran for, I think, over a decade. And when I first heard that talk, I was at university and I really did feel very stifled. I trained at UCL. I felt a lot of the things that I wanted to do. So I intercalated with medical anthropology, kind of the humanities within medicine. And that aspect of things was just completely absent. And I didn't really feel like I fit in or could find a discipline that spoke to me. So when I started reading Chimamanda's work and also looking at her TED Talks, I actually found that was really resonating with my own experiences. And actually, it's something that I've really tried to center and challenge. So when I'm trying to bring different historical perspectives and looking at medicine, looking at the history of medicine, I actually have that idea of kind of whitewashing and who gets to speak in the forefront of my mind. I think that it starts so much earlier than obviously the higher education process. So I think people were conditioned to, in her other talk where she says we should all be feminists, at other talks, she talks about shrinking yourselves. And I think a lot of us are taught to shrink ourselves really, really early. You're too loud, too demanding. And I think then it's really hard to unbreak some of those patterns as you go through the educational process and the higher education process. So I think it starts much earlier in terms of our conditioning. And sometimes actually, I think by the time that we get to higher education, I think trying to address the danger of the single story is actually a bit too late. People don't want to tell their story because they've been conditioned to think they're unimportant.
Yes, I think, I mean, that might be true, but I think we still have to encourage them to tell that story. I totally agree with what you said, that because I say the whole thing needs to start from nursery school. It needs to start much earlier. This whole idea of EDI, I always talk about going in to read with the children right from the get-go, that let them interact, particularly in areas where they don't see a lot of racial diversity, so that people can interact with us all on a one-to-one level and realise that everybody is human. You know, we all share the same overall human experience, and it's not the colour of the skin. Sometimes people have been raised by parents to look upon Black boys with fear. And so they look at every single Black boy that they see with fear. You know, whereas if this Black boy is in school reading with them, they begin to realise that, no, they are different and they have differences, just the same way that my dad is different to my uncle, but they're both white men, right? So it's trying to introduce the normality of every person early on. But we are where we are. And so we do need to do what we can to encourage at every level people to tell their story, whether they have the courage to do so in a room, or whether, as I say, you call them afterwards on a one-to-one level. And we have to find ways. You can go back to the old-fashioned cardboard box or box with a key, paper, write your opinion and post it, or send an email or whatever. But we have to find ways to allow every person to participate and to feel that they belong. When I first trained in Sheffield, so in the late 1990s, early 2000. You'd walk into a room in society and be the only Black person. And I'm saying something like the theatre, the cinema. So never mind medical. In general, out there in society, I'd be the only Black person, not Black woman, Black person. I still go to conferences these days, radiology conferences, and see one or two others. We tend to give ourselves a look, and we all know. One, if I'm lucky, I see one or two others, or I may see no one. So people have got to find a way of being courageous enough to tell their stories in that sort of environment, and the white allies to see these individuals and provide the protection, provide them with that safety that they need so that they can tell their story.
I don't know if you saw my shock. I just didn't know in Sheffield that there were no Black people at some point. So I I was like, what in Sheffield?
I'm talking about 1998, 1999, 2000.
Which isn't that long ago.
Not that long ago. You would go, and maybe the Black people did not go to the theatre to watch the play I was going to watch. I don't know. But I can assure you that I was in there and there would be no one else. Your generation doesn't know. I count you both as being much younger than my generation. You know, my daughters and my children are probably your age, and that's the reality of what we saw.
Yeah, because you mentioned about creating spaces for people to talk about these stories, but can you describe your journey to taking action for social justice that's kind of led to disrupting hierarchies in healthcare and academia?
I mean, I love the way you say that. I don't know that I would describe myself as somebody who had disrupted any hierarchy, but I can certainly tell you my experiences. I have to confess that right up until I got to be professor, I was focused on getting to be a professor. And so I was the sort of person, I told you that story, the very first interview. I was born in this country. My sister and I were the only black people, coloured people, not even black, in our primary school. And then I went to a boarding school where I was the only black person. And then I came to Nigeria, did medicine, university, secondary school, university, and came back. So my first interview to get the first medical job I had, actually I got the job at the first interview, but I had to apply for about 100 and something jobs before I got it. The man said to me, you obviously speak English, we'll give you the job, you obviously speak English. So that was the beginning of this sort of microaggression. I just did not, I decided to not focus on these statements, because if I did, it would have paralyzed me. I'm the sort of person, I don't forget anything. I can remember things. And so if I had concentrated on those things and put them in that side of my memory that doesn't forget anything, I would have been paralyzed. I wouldn't have been able to do anything. And so I didn't see these microaggressions. I didn't see this racism because I just didn't want to. I knew that there were these things, so I didn't apply for promotion. I'd go and speak to the individuals in the higher up the hierarchy that we were talking about. I'd go and speak to them, and if there was any doubt in their voices as to whether I'd get promoted or not, I just didn't apply. I have the benefit, a clinical academic is on an NHS scale, pay scale, and so the promotions within the university weren't having any impact on my salary, so I didn't have that pressure, didn't need to apply for promotions. But when I did finally apply and I got my promotion to professor in church, we have a church group that we used to go to on, I want to say it was Wednesday evenings. We had a connect, our church connect group. And one of the persons whose house, one of our lead pastors there said, you just be, do you know there are no other black female professors in medicine? And I said, of course there are. And he said, no, there aren't. Anyway, he Googled it. And I think I was the third. And I mean, what kind of number is that? How can there only be two other black female professors in medicine ever? And then it turned out that it was something like 30 something. I don't know what the number was. There are 41. Let me say now, that was 2000. This is 2003. There are now 41 black female professors in United Kingdom. How is that possible, right? So when I was hearing these statistics, that's it was suddenly as if all of these memories that I had shielded myself from all started coming out. And it was really, it's not good enough. It's not good enough. It's beyond people not being interested, and obviously it's not that people are not able. There has got to be something on a grander scale that is making these numbers so appalling. And it was at that point that people would, I got a lot of feedback in terms of, I don't see anybody that looks like me. And that not seeing anybody looking like them was also preventing people from moving forward. It wasn't the case for me. I think that it's a challenge. If nobody looks like me, I'm just gonna go. I knew what I wanted to achieve. I wasn't in too much of a rush. I didn't want to apply and be turned down. But when all of these, everything just collided at the same time. So I was also at that point, I'd been on our Staff Race Equality Network committee. And because of that role, people were coming to tell me their stories. And I got promoted and I heard these numbers. And like I say, all the different things I had put behind me and wasn't thinking of, because they would have paralyzed me, all started coming out. The very first, I gave a lecture during lockdown, the first virtual meeting I gave, and they asked me to give examples of racism, and I wasn't expecting the question, and I couldn't think of any examples because of my wall. But everything was starting to just fall apart, and I do have them. Obviously, I know examples of racism against me, but it just shows you what we do to protect ourselves. My calling is now to make it fair, to make it, to like I said to you at the beginning, if you go through experiences, and you don't share them, then what has been the point to try and so others don't have to?
I think for me, I was always acutely aware that there were, I never saw any Black women in senior academic positions the entirety of my academic training. I mean, I saw obviously Black consultants few and far between because I have family friends that are medics, but they weren't particularly within academic spaces. I wasn't really lectured by any. And I think there is something in being able to see something so you can be it. I think in terms of your question and causing disruption, I think my own upbringing made me see that the problem lies far deeper. So I'm of Nigerian heritage, British Nigerian heritage. I was born here and I was raised here and I went to school here. And my family is quite diverse. I know, think you've touched on classism already, but a lot of my cousins went to comprehensive schools. I went to a really small private school and then I went to a really elitist institution. So I've always predominantly white spaces. And my family history is such that we've always kind of gone between Britain and Nigeria, and my grandma moved here in the 50s. And I think you're often taught, like, you know, if you just really work really hard and diligently, that you'll get, you know, the best outcome and you can be whatever you want to be. And I think that is important in allowing people to dream and for people to encourage people to not lose hope. But I think for me, it was really apparent that there is a tiered structure to society. As in the school I went to, I would see my friends have tutors and I would see them basically we'd be given, you know, exam papers that really, our mocks would look really like the exams that we got, right? And there were all these things that are just really heavily weighted in favor, and it starts at the beginning. And of course I had barriers when I was at these schools. Like, I remember when I said I wanted to do medicine, even though my dad's a medic, they knew that. And I obviously had the grades, the typical things where people would really undermine you, and they gave my personal statement to someone else, all of these kind of things that happened. But ultimately I saw that the system that I'd be put into by my parents would set me up for success from the beginning, because they were paying for success. And if you did the things right, most people would get a good outcome. But ultimately, lots of people don't have access to that system, those networks that allow you to get the work experience that you need. Even now, by virtue of the school I went to and the circles I mixed in, I have access to people that others are going to really struggle to have access to, you know, because I went to school with them and now they're an editor of that magazine and now they're a photographer here, and people don't have access to those people. And so for me, I guess in many ways, I'm what people call a class traitor, and I love talking about classism. And a lot of people, if you're put in the system and it works for you and you get a positive outcome, you're just told not to talk about it. You're told not to tell anybody all the secrets and how, yeah, you might go to a comprehensive and you might work really hard, but that when you look at the statistics, those people are few and far between. And it's honestly near impossible to break through that system unless you have significant help or somebody that really chooses to uplift you, whether that's a teacher or a parent. So for me, I think my upbringing and seeing that from the beginning, a lot of people in my life, whether it's my cousins or family friends, we were put on a really different path and they were always going to have to work harder. And yes, I might be intelligent and yes, I might be talented, but there were so many other things beyond what I was going to do that had already set up to work in my favor. And I think subsequently, that's always just really bothered me. And lots of people have been really fine with thinking that they're the best and they're the brightest. And I'm really happy to acknowledge that I'm probably not. And there's lots of other things that we need to talk about. And I saw these things firsthand, how lots of people at my school would take drugs and they all got lovely jobs in the city and no one will ever care. But the people that, you know, smoked a little weed at the school down the road would be getting stopped and searched and have their chances and future hampered. So for me, it was really shaped by my own family set of circumstances. And I don't think other people necessarily, when they're growing up, grow up alongside so many people from so many different walks of life, we tend to stay in our bubble, and it really colors people's perspective of how the world is.
I think it's interesting the generations that we represent, because I also went to boarding school here from 10 to about 12 or 13, as I mentioned, but I was sort of 10, 11, 9, 10, 11, 12, and I was the only black girl. I was the only minority boarding. There was another girl who was Lebanese, and I think subsequently we were joined by an Ethiopian girl a year or two down the line. But it was extraordinarily isolating. And what I remember the most, and I had no, apart from the fact that my parents had an aspiration for their children to send me to send them to boarding school, I had nothing in common with these girls. These were people who went horse riding, whose houses were probably, whose sort of garage probably the size of our house, where we, you know, where we had lived in England. The accents, I mean, you think my accent is posh, but no. You know, it was a completely, and they had, a lot of them had never seen a black person. And so there was racism, and I spent my days, I learned about the stars. I used to count, I used to just write poetry in my head. And I was failing at everything. This is one of the reasons why my parents took me away from that boarding school and brought me back to Nigeria where they were. And so I finished the final few years of secondary school and university in Nigeria, almost from the get-go, from being amongst lots of other black girls, and some had been in England and some hadn't. Almost from the get-go, I could do maths. I was suddenly a different person and flourished. And I think that had I stayed in that boarding school and finished, I think my experience would not have been the same as yours. I think I would have not been perceived as clever. I wouldn't have done medicine. Maybe it was the boarding school, maybe it was the time. So that was in the late 70s, early 80s. And you're now getting the support within these sort of elite environments that I really wasn't getting. I don't know, but I think that I had the best of it as it could possibly be, in a way that I wasn't left to flounder in that school. I came back to Nigeria. I started doing well, and I developed confidence and a certain sense that I could do things. But also, though, that same work ethic, that cultural, you have to work. And you have to work, because sometimes some things are luck. But if you haven't worked, you can't take that luck, because you're not in a position to.
Just to clarify, I actually wanted to say that earlier when you were speaking, that I think it's good that obviously clearly in society we can see there is some level of progression and things have improved. However, when you were talking about your own experiences in these spaces and being the only white, you know, the only black face in these white spaces, I was going to say it's really sad and disheartening to me, because I already knew this from some people that I'd spoken to that had grown up in similar circumstances, but actually it hasn't progressed that much, because I was in school in the 2000s and I graduated medical school in 2014. And ultimately, my experience actually was widely the same. So actually, I went to these elitist schools and they weren't very supportive. The fact that I got like all these A stars and these A's, it was actually really shocking. Like, so I was told that I couldn't do separate sciences, and that I, at one point, they said I should do single science, you know? And even in year six, doing SATs, and I really wanted to take the level six paper in English because I knew that I was good at this. And the teacher said, absolutely not. She was like, no. And it was the only person that didn't take that paper. I remember I was only 11 that didn't take that paper and still got straight fives. And you think 11-year-olds won't remember these things happening to them, but you really do. So I always, you know, it is really challenging, because I know that in a way, getting access to those places really does set you up in terms of other social aspects. But it can be, as you said, there's a phrase that academically in social sciences, I think it's called a spirit crushing in black feminist spaces, they use. But undoubtedly, nearly everybody I know that's black, including my brother that went to those elitist schools and environments, your spirit was crushed. I remember I used to wear really colorful clothing when I arrived at that school as a 15-year-old, And by the time I left, I just put on some preppy clothes. I actually remember I never knew what Abercrombie and Finch really was, or like polo shirts, but I just learned to conform. I like was like no trainers, like all of these things. And now as an adult, I look at that and I think, wow, how striking that they literally sucked the color out of you in that time period. But I was just so exhausted. And I felt that again at medical school, I have to be honest, like by the time I left medical school, I was honestly on my knees. I was like, I just felt so crushed by the whole experience. And I think this is still happening. There is still something really deep and layered, not just racism, but also the fact that Black people aren't intellectual. People don't want you to be intellectual. They'll push you and steer you to like really physical things, and you can be sporty, but you can also be intellectual, and people feel really threatened by it. And I think it's progressed, but I also do think it's people still having their spirit crushed quite regularly.
I don't know what the level of GCSE is that they offer you that's not GCSE. There was something I remember when my mother came back to England with my younger sister and brothers, and she was saying to my sister, she'd go to boarding school and come back, and she'd go and come back for holidays. When aren't you doing your GCSEs? When are you doing your GCSEs? And my sister had said to her, no, I'm not down for GCSEs. I'm going to do, I can't remember what they said, told me it was. It was something that wasn't GCSEs, right? And my mother said, that's not happening. My mother has a PhD. She said, why? And she went back to the school, boarding school, I bet, you know, and they said, well, she'd, having come from Nigeria, we thought that we didn't want her to do the exams, fail, and then have mental consequences. And my mum said, well, let her do the exams and fail, and we'll handle the mental consequences when they happen. That particular sister, she graduated as a doctor and did psychology. So it's they have this assumption for that comes you should judge a person by their actual ability in front of you. You shouldn't make your prejudgments, and sometimes people end up almost falling into the category that you ask them to. So my sister was just not going to bother and do anything. And if you don't do GCSEs, you have no GCSEs, right? And if you have no GCSEs, you're not going to be a doctor. So they're you're already sort of predicting a person's outcome just by not letting them attempt anything. But the minute you say you're going to do your GCSEs, you have to do GCSEs, you need to do well. She tries her best, and lo and behold, she graduates as a doctor. I wanted to pick up on what you were saying about crushing the spirit. I can handle myself in an academic environment. I don't mind being at work and being the only Black person or going to a conference. I don't think I would want to, I don't want it to be that way. I want others to be there. But I think that there's the other aspect is you go to the conference, you're the only Black person, but I'm okay. I do, this is my area. I can stand on the podium. I can present my talk. I'm the managing editor of the journal. I can do what I want to do. I've been in it for many years now, and now I've made friends and people know me and people has the respect. And the few, if there's anybody there who is racist or whatever, then they come to me and I don't come to them. There's no interaction. I fit in, I belong. But in the day, before you get to that level, the social aspect of these conferences is what is strangling. You know, it's okay when you're in the auditorium and people are giving lectures. Maybe you're nervous because of your own 3-minute presentation, but you give it and you come back and you sit down. But when you have to then go to the welcome reception or the dinner or whatever the social things are, or even the lunch breaks, which are buffet style, it's the hanging around looking for the other minority persons that you can both talk to each other because you haven't ever been skiing. Or you don't play golf. Do you know what I mean? And nobody's automatically assuming some sort of inferiority that you have. So I can use my, I suppose what I'm saying is that I can use the academic achievements as a cloak to hide behind. But when you have to strip that off, you have to be yourself. That's that there is that problem as well. So people are struggling on two levels is ultimately the point. Breaking hierarchies, we do mentoring. One of the things that UKRI has funded, a project called Generation Delta, and 6 of us, Black female professors, Black in the wider context, Asian and African and Afro-Caribbean, 6 of us, Generation Delta, we're all 6 Black female professors, and we're trying to, our project concentrates on Black female academics, postgraduate, PhD, trying to keep them up in academia. And it's the same thing that they all talk about, the PhD students that we've held some student workshops. It's the loneliness that the project brings them together. And they're all looking, thinking, my goodness, I mean, there's this many of us. And we have, and they have the six professors in the room, and we're mentoring as well. So it's being that face that they need to see. But because there's so few of us, unless we bring ourselves together, with 41 professors, how are you ever going to see any of them? That's not one per university.
And I think, yeah, I think I'm so glad you brought up the cultural fit aspect, because obviously that has stood kind of in my favor, because even if I don't do those things, or those aren't necessarily things that interest me, I've learned to talk the talk. I can code switch. The organization, I think you both might be aware of, like Melanin Medics, I've like done talks with them before, and they're doing great work. And I remember I said to them, it's really unfortunate, I wrote an article for iNews about kind of the gap of Black consultants, particularly like in London, that was done in terms of hires and consultants happening. People were asking, like, how do we address this? And I said, the unfortunate reality of this situation is, I don't think that you should have to change yourself and have the color sucked out of you like I did at school. But I do think you, at this point in time, we all still need to play the game, unfortunately. And there is a game to be played, in that there is a culture within medicine. And, you know, my dad in the 70s used to talk about the interview by Cherry, right? The Cherry test. Like, do you play golf? Can they speak to you? Are they going to be really awkward having this Black man or this Asian man in the department? And it's really awful, but these things, yeah, they've got better. They still really exist. And I do think we owe it to a generation for them to challenge the dominant structures, and not just challenge, dismantle them. And you can be really forceful with how you do that. And you can say you don't want to conform. But then we also really run the risk of people not even getting into those roles still, because there is still that really dominant hierarchy of what is considered good culture. And having to conform to the status quo. And it's got more toxic in the last few years because of other things that are going on politically. And I think there is an aspect of people expecting people to behave a certain way. So I think we need to do things like this and still have these conversations and say, this isn't the case. Even now, my hair is extremely messy, but I, you know, I always have like my sister locks in, I have my beads in my hair, I have, you know, I'm a doctor with piercings, I have tattoos, and those aspects of things also are things that people aren't expecting about you, and adds to kind of the barriers and discrimination you face. And we have to talk about that. We have to push against these things of what people's expectations are. But I do think there's also something about the mentoring system of people that haven't been schooled or gone through these systems. They've been trained abroad, or they have come from comprehensive schools, at least them understanding the culture that they're about to have to slot themselves into and network in, because that is one of the things that is crushing and makes people drop out. And it's so sad to see people go through all of med school and then get into their foundation program, or even get into their training program, and they can't manage, because it's just so overwhelming that the culture is just so isolating and they feel so marginalized, and it is still happening.
Yeah, and also what you were saying is not all of us, my father was a doctor too, not all of us have got family who have been to university, either here or abroad or anywhere. They are the first in their families to receive higher level education, and they don't know who to go to help navigate the system. And there is a lot of it, as you were saying earlier, that is about who you know. And what you, and rather than what actually do you know, how able are you as an individual? It's even just getting, knowing that there's a job advert going somewhere. You know, where do you read? Where do you look? What do you do? How do you know about it? How do you hear about it? And there's just there's a lot of things that we need to change. I do think that we also though have to be wary of that. There's being yourself and expressing yourself. But there's also having the respect for the patients that you're going to see, and the families who are anxious that their loved one is dying, right? So I'm quite sure that your hair is not scatty and all over the place when you're going to the wards, for example. So what we're saying is everybody should be allowed to express themselves whilst maintaining there is a level of things that are beyond culture. It's just respecting each other.
Yeah, of course. And I think it's about being obviously tidy, but I think, you know, being the unfortunate thing is that when we talk about race and we talk about kind of Eurocentrism, unfortunately, professional standards in my opinion are very bound up with those things. But I think that idea, when I was in medical school, this is something else that was before people even had their afros out, I just decided like I was going to have mine out. And it wasn't necessarily a political stance. I actually just prefer my hair that way. Obviously, people politicize it, but it's seen as inherently messy. And my afro was super short because I had to cut off all my relaxed hairs. It was like a really small afro. And it also became apparent to me, even very internalized from other Black people and clinicians and consultants, they would be like, you're making us look bad. When are you going to put in extensions? And the hair's brushed. The hair is tidy. It was short. It was neat. And I think there are things that sometimes are racialized in a way that we probably don't even appreciate ourselves. So of course, my hair flowing around now, I'm out and about and I've been rushing and driving, I wouldn't go to clinic like this because it's getting the way. But the idea that you should inherently like not have locks on your head, for example, that's very bound up racially with ideas of people that have locks being vagrants and, you know, useless people, right? I do think we have to also understand that some of these ideas, and we perpetuate them, and it can be really challenging for people that just want to just have their locks. I know plenty of people that have locks that actually are not particularly, you know, like Black power. They just have locks. Of course, we need to say we want to come to work and want to be professional and people want to be their authentic selves. I also think we have to ask sometimes why certain things are seen as inherently unprofessional when it's people just wearing their hair or just being themselves.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that any particular hairstyle is in itself disrespectful. I meant actually the state of the hair at the time of that hairstyle. I mean, I'm sitting here with sister locks also, so it's, you know, I definitely like locks and they're great. My brothers would go back to boarding school with their hair cut really short, really, really short, not completely bald, but the teachers would say they're not allowed to have skinheads. And we'd say, well, actually, in our culture, this is neat. This means that these boys are neat and tidy. I think people should be open to learning what is right within a culture. You cannot have Caucasian hair and then be dictating to a non-Caucasian what is neat by your standards. One needs to understand and learn, and I think that's really important. I can have sister locks and look completely disrespectful, and it's not because of the sister locks per se. It's everything. It's the whole entire picture. And that's what needs to be judged.
And just to finish, like kind of maybe on a more like on the future as well, how can we ensure we have like an inclusive strategy when we're working towards decolonizing academia and healthcare?
So I think one thing I'm very mindful of is in this area, of course, like any other area, people have their different approaches. People have their different ways of doing things. I think when you're asking for more and you're identifying a problem in the system, you have to be really mindful of people obviously pushing against what you're doing to maintain the status quo, and also people reproducing versions that look better, but they don't do very much, right? And I think we're seeing universities and lots of organizations, bigger organizations, that honestly, I never thought when I started having this conversation nearly 10 years ago, you'd have huge organizations, whether it's like the British Medical Journal or the Lancet, even really trying to engage with some of this like colonial history or neo-colonial structures. I didn't think it was going to happen this soon. Obviously, we had the events of the last few years, like with the pandemic and highlighted some real disparities and made people more willing to have those conversations. But I think we also have to be really mindful of like the co-optation of language and how people say they're doing things, but actually nothing really changes. We'll still have statistics where we only have 41 Black women professors, right? So people will have done all of this innovation and said they've done all these projects for 5 years, but actually it's not created any actual real significant change. No power's been yielded. Organizations that were doing really awful things are still there. So I think for me, it's really just being mindful that when people say they're decolonizing the curriculum or they're going to do a diversity inclusion project at the university, I actually am very much like, we have a lot of talking shops. We do a lot of talking. We've done a lot of talking and writing about these issues and looking at the huge attainment gaps and things like that exist. I'm really very much for this phase of, I need to see results. Now, like, I'm really not interested in having another symposium on like decolonizing the curriculum unless you're coming here to present what's changed between your cohorts 0 and 5. I want to see differences. I want your students to tell me that they feel different because of some of what we've said today. You know, we're decades apart in our educational experiences, and yet our narratives are strikingly similar.
Yes, where do I even start? There are so many surveys being done to collect data, so much asking people, so much talking about, we want to do this or that, we want to decolonize the curriculum. I think we have to ask ourselves what it is we want to achieve. Why are you wanting to decolonize the curriculum? And also each university does not need to, reinvent decolonizing the curriculum. I feel that we need to have a much more unified approach to it. You know, University of Sheffield Medical School, UCL Medical School, Manchester and Liverpool and Birmingham. Are we all decolonizing our curricula separately? That's a lot of manpower, a lot of effort, a lot of hours. To what extent and for why? So we need to be really clear that, for example, our skin colour does affect the way bruises appear, does affect the way jaundice appears. These are important and crucial. There are other aspects that if you're looking at the history of medicine, who has contributed, but you're doing it ultimately for equity for all of us, and so that patients' health outcomes are equal, are maximised, are optimised, and those are the things we ultimately should be looking at, because certainly within health, we're in medicine, or I'm certainly in medicine, I'm not saying that Annabelle isn't, I just couldn't work out whether she's still doing medicine or whether she's a journalist or
I'm all of the things.
You're all of them. Okay, fantastic. She's a multitasker par excellence. So and so we do, in terms of when she has her health hat on, we want to make the health outcomes fantastic for everybody. And if you're decolonizing the curriculum, but neonates, Black neonates are still dying, what you're not achieving, okay? It's not just to say yes, we've done so many man hours and we've changed this and that in our textbooks. What impact ultimately did you want it to have, and is it having that impact? And I think that's what we need to look at, and we need to do it collaboratively, because actually, if you think about the medical curriculum, and if you think about the English curriculum or the history or the politics or the science, there's a whole lot of man hours. We could spend the rest of our lives, literally our academic lives, working lives, just decolonizing all the different curricula.
And I absolutely agree, especially as somebody working in the academically in the humanities. I think there is an issue within academia of people doing things, unfortunately, to further their their academic careers and decolonizing. We can't lie, it's hot property at the moment. It's people want to get grants around this, people get fellowships around this, and actually people are emailing me every week from a medical school saying, we're doing this overhaul, can you have eyes on it, and these kinds of things. And ultimately, if nothing is changing, who, as you said, is this all for, and what is the purpose of it? And often I'm sorry, but I think the aims behind it are quite self-interested rather than actually trying to address the structural issues that are leading to some of these statistics. And just to highlight something else you mentioned, there were really huge issues within various areas of medicine. Obviously, I've written a whole book about it, but when we look at psychiatry, I was interviewing the race task force at the Royal College of Psychiatry, and now Dr. Shalade Smith is president there. And I was interviewing her, and she was talking about her long academic history of like looking at the racial disparities and how we think about race and diagnosis. But the fact that it's become really normalized in psychiatry to talk about like child trauma and sexual trauma. And within a normal history for psychiatry, nobody talks about racial trauma as a trigger for mental illness. And even how we conceptualize why Black men have schizophrenia in such high numbers and never get diagnosed with depression. So there are real huge issues. And what happens when you get a schizophrenia diagnosis? You get much more harsh treatment in detention, in the criminal justice system. So these are real big issues. And unless people are really trying to look at the big things, that's really what I think I want to see from the future. I think these are the big issues that need addressing that are having profound consequences on communities' lives and reinforcing disparities within communities. And I think people are kind of gravitating towards some of the easy conversations, even within this massive topic. And I would like people to actually start addressing some of the more challenging bits of this conversation now as well.
Well, we need to see change. I don't even care. You don't have to call it EDI. You don't have to call it decolonizing the curriculum. It all becomes, we just have phrases that are the buzzword of the time. And when it actually comes to things happening, nothing happens. You want diversity, but how are you advertising the role? Where are you advertising the role? How are you actually making sure that the applicants are diverse? Because if the applicants aren't diverse, you're not going to get diversity in your environment. We talked about the last year's the Race Observatory's paper. So many aspects, 5 key aspects of health they looked at, and there was racial disparity in all of them. The NHS helped put their hand up and they said they've got things they want to do. But if we look at papers in the next 5 years, will they show a difference? So saying we want, we all want, right? Everybody wants. But what is actually being done to show the actions that are going to make these things change? And that's what we need. That's what we need. Action.
What a wonderful place to leave it on and finish that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you.
In today's podcast, we talked about hierarchies and how they're built, Annabelle and Namaka's experiences in medicine and academia, disruption, the impact of change. The conversation made me think about being a class traitor. When Annabelle said this and went on to talk about how it is the best kept secret, it resonated with me a lot. Many of us are empowered by this idea of free education and equal opportunities for all in the UK. However, most people attending top ranking universities and a high proportion of clinical academics have been to a selective school like a grammar school or paid to go to a private school. There is clearly a conflict between the idea and the reality when it comes to equal opportunities. I feel this shows why we need to explore, disrupt, and transform hierarchies in education. I'm so grateful to Amaka and Annabelle for their time, insights, wisdom, and pushing the boundaries to decrease health disparities. Thank you for listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, brought to you by Black and Brown in Bioethics. Be sure to visit blackbrown.blogs.bristol.ac.uk to listen to more of our podcasts, follow our work, and connect with our network. Credits. Thank you to the Centre for Ethics in Medicine at the University of Bristol and to the Ethos Centre at the University of Oxford for all their support. Thank you to Dr. Kasim Ashra for providing intro and outro beats.